The headlines: Iran blames Israel for the recent terrorist attack on a defense facility in Isfahan, saying it reserves a right to respond to such actions. Israeli aircraft carry out new strikes on the central Gaza Strip. Palestinian resistance groups respond with powerful anti-aircraft fire. And calls are growing for accountability and an end to U.S. police brutality as a funeral service is held for a black man recently killed by Memphis police. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Our top story for this half hour: Iran's ambassador to the UN says a preliminary investigation shows Israel was responsible for Saturday's terrorist attack on a military site in the central Iranian city of Isfahan. Saidi Ravani also pointed out Israeli Prime Minister's recent interview with U.S. media, in which he admitted to, quote, taking action against certain weapons development sites in Iran. Ravani called Israel's assault a brazen violation of international law and urged the U.N. Security Council to hold the regime accountable. The Iranian diplomat stressed that his country reserves a right to defend its national security and respond to any aggression or threats by Israel. Iravani also condemned as provocative and responsible a tweet by Ukraine's presidential advisor on the drone attack in which he alleged Iran for providing weapons to Russia. This is while Tehran has repeatedly denied giving weapons to Moscow to be used in the Ukraine war. Iran and Nicaragua have signed a memorandum of understanding for cooperation and political consultations as Tehran looks forward to boost ties with Latin American countries. Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, signed the document during his visit to Managua. Speaking at the Nicaraguan foreign ministry, Amir Abdullahian called Latin America one of the main pillars of Tehran's foreign policy. He said Iran-Nicaragua relations are expanding at a fast pace. The top Nicaraguan diplomat, for his part, said boosting relations are in the interest of both countries. He also stressed that Managua and Tehran remain committed to peace and to defend the rights of their citizens. Iran and Nicaragua signed 14 documents on comprehensive cooperation last year. Iranians are celebrating the 44th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution that led to the ouster of the U.S.-backed Pahlavi regime. The celebrations, starting on February the 1st, coincide with the return of late Imam Khomeini from several years of exile in 1979 and culminated in nationwide rallies 10 days later. Gisu Misha Ahmadi has more.
The 44th anniversary of the late Imam Khomeini's return to Iran from several years of exile, marking the beginning of 10 days of celebrations. In Iran, festivities have begun, with Iranians from all walks of life gathering in the mausoleum of Imam Khomeini to renew their pledge of allegiance to the late founder of the Islamic Revolution, while a special ceremony is also underway, demonstrating that the divide-and-rule policy of the enemies of the Islamic Revolution has failed.
I've come here to renew my pledge of allegiance with Imam Khomeini, who was an advocate of social justice and at the forefront of fighting oppressors worldwide.
Assyrians have been living in Iran for more than 3,000 years. This shows that no matter what our enemies do, we will remain united as a nation.
Over the past 44 years, we have managed to overcome many obstacles simply because we remain united, and it's important for our nation to remain that way.
A point that was also raised by the keynote speaker of the ceremony, Parliament Speaker Mohammad Baqir Ghalibaf.
The Islamic Revolution is known worldwide with the name of Imam Khomeini, a great man known for fighting imperialism, who always invited the nation to be united in the face of our enemies' plots and said, "You know, you're walking down the right path when your enemies do everything they can to stop you. If your enemies are ever indifferent, it is a clear sign that we have deviated from the right path. So their increased animosity is actually a good sign."
That is why the presence of masses at the mausoleum this year is more significant than previous years, considering a period of foreign-backed riots in the country and Western countries increasing political pressure on Iran to unprecedented levels.
We are here to say that we are proud of our revolution and our country.
When Imam Khomeini needed our support to topple the Pahlavi regime, my sons did not hesitate.
I am here to say that I will always support the leader and the Islamic revolution.
My son gave his life for this revolution, and I am here to uphold his values. Iranians are celebrating the 44th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution at a time when they've managed to thwart foreign-backed riots in the country and bring peace and calm back to all the cities across Iran. More than anything, the 44th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution is a show of solidarity. Gisumish Ahmadi, Tehran.
Israeli aircraft have carried out new strikes against the besieged Gaza Strip amid rising tensions over the regime's deadly crackdown in the occupied territories. Israeli missiles targeted several positions of the Palestinian resistance groups in the center and south of Gaza with missiles. The resistance groups responded by firing anti-aircraft missiles. They also fired rockets at the Israeli settlements near Gaza, following which sirens went off in those settlements. Israel claims that the strike came in response to earlier rocket fire from Gaza. Tensions have been rising since Friday when the Israeli forces raided the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank, killing at least 9 people. The situation has raised concerns of a broader crackdown by Israel's new cabinet, which is seen as the most extremist that is in the regime's history. Our Gaza correspondent Ashraf Shannon joined us earlier with more details about the latest Israeli airstrikes against the besieged Gaza Strip.
The Israeli attacks targeted Hamas security installations around 2 a.m. This morning. The Israeli regime claims that the airstrikes were retaliation for a rocket fire from the Gaza Strip. This while Palestinian resistance groups have reportedly fired rockets towards the occupied territories. At least 3 small homemade rockets towards the occupied territories of 1948. Sources say that the rockets were fired in retaliation to the Israeli forces' attack on female Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli jails over the last 48 hours, as well as the bad treatment of the entire prisoner population within Israeli jails and detention centers over the last days. Things are extremely tense as Israeli drones continue to fly over the skies of the Gaza Strip. And during the airstrikes, Al-Mujahideen movement fired at least one surface-to-air missile at the incoming Israeli aircraft, as well as Hamas's Ezzedine Qassam brigades fired an anti-aircraft fire to deter the attack of the Israeli fighter jets, drones, and Apache helicopter gunships around between 2 and 3 a.m. This morning.
Palestinian inmates in Israeli jails warn to adopt a set of measures, including prolonged hunger strikes, to protest against growing aggression by Israeli prisons officials. Prisoners held 2-day hunger strikes as the Israeli prison administration has intensified its punitive measures against Palestinian prisoners, mainly female inmates.
For the last few days, the situation inside Israeli jails has been intolerable for thousands of Palestinian prisoners. The regime's prisons administration continues its violations against Palestinian inmates, starting with large-scale transfers of prisoners, storming inmate cells, and confiscating their belongings. Palestinians say it's a strategy to weaken and destabilize resistance within the prisons in a bid to further stifle the captive movement that follows the prisoners' issues behind bars. Far-right Israeli Minister Itamar Ben-Gavir has ordered the closure of bakeries inside the Rimon and Kidzyat jails. These bakeries are run by prisoners themselves to provide bread to their fellow inmates in other jails.
A number of measures are being taken today against the captive movement since taking the role in the most far-right regime. Ben-Gavir announced plans to implement several punitive measures against incarcerated Palestinians, and he's continuing with more aggressive decisions. These measures are meant to drag the Palestinian prisoners into confrontations with the soldiers.
A large-scale campaign of aggression has been carried out by the prison's administration against Palestinian prisoners, particularly the female prisoners. A number of them had been assaulted by Israeli soldiers who broke into their cells. They had also prohibited family visits. Talks have been held between the prisoners and the Israeli prison service. However, the prison service rejected the inmates' key demands. Thus, it's expected that the prisoners will even escalate their protest measures within the coming days. Palestinian prisoners have been trying to resist the crackdown through all possible means, including going on hunger strikes and remaining in their cells, a move seen by the prison's administration as disobeying the orders and challenging the soldiers.
The vicious attack on the prisoners will lead to serious consequences. The prisoners are not alone. They always find support and serious stand from the whole Palestinians. It seems this current regime wants a war on all fronts because the situation in the occupied territories is already boiling.
According to the Commission of Prisoners' Affairs, today 4,700 prisoners are languishing in Israeli jails, including 29 women and 150 children. 850 are held under administrative detention without charge or trial. Palestinian prisoners are routinely subjected to systematic torture by the Israeli regime. This is while all they have done was to bravely stand up against the occupation of their homeland. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
Well, Ukraine has reported more casualties in eastern Donbas region as Russia intensifies its attacks ahead of the first anniversary of its military operation there. The Ukrainian military says Russian forces have struck the city of Bakhmut in Donetsk province and at least 10 nearby towns and villages. Separately, Ukrainian police say Russian missile strikes on several apartment buildings in the eastern city of Kramatorsk have left 3 people dead and 20 others injured. President Volodymyr Zelensky says the situation has become tougher as Russia is seeking for more gains before February the 24th. That's the day when Russia began its offensive against Ukraine. Last year, Zelensky has already requested for new weapons and their fast deliveries from his Western backers. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen announces new enforcement measures at EU borders to control the movement of asylum seekers. Rights campaigners describe the bloc's refugee policies racist and discriminatory. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
The situation for refugees in and around the European Union is getting worse by the day. At a meeting of EU lawmakers in Brussels on Wednesday, it was announced tougher controls will be used on the border between EU member Bulgaria and non-member Turkey.
Like drones and radar and other means of surveillance. As we've done last year, for example, in the last years, for example, in Romania, we've done it in Spain and Greece and in Poland.
EU institutions and leaders are accused of breaking international law surrounding the protection of refugees.
What is the EU answer to these protection gaps? More walls, more drones, more returns, more funding to Libyan detention centres.
Campaigners say shunned refugees are fleeing countries destabilised by the West. At the same time, millions of Ukrainians are being welcomed here and given the same rights as EU citizens. Legislators are calling on EU leaders to provide safe, legal routes for refugees.
We need to guarantee the right to asylum for those who need shelter so they are not shamefully piled up in refugee camps or illegally pushed back or drowned in the Mediterranean Sea.
The EU is currently developing a new asylum policy, but it's already shrouded in scepticism.
The Commission has to step up to break the cycle of mistrust existing between member states by enforcing also rules, also current rules.
Many EU nations are now struggling to accommodate the millions of Ukrainian refugees who have travelled here. Thousands more continue to arrive each day. Agencies across the EU that are already overwhelmed warn breaking point is being reached. They are demanding additional resources from governments. Jerome Hughes, the European Parliament, Brussels.
Americans are calling for an end to police brutality as they mourn the killing of Tyre Nichols, an African-American man who was beaten to death by Memphis City Police.
You don't stand up to thugs in the street becoming thugs yourself. You don't fight gangs by becoming 5 armed men against an unarmed man.
We have to fight for justice. We cannot continue to let these people brutalize our kids.
We need to take some action because there should be no other child that should suffer the way my son and all the other parents here have lost their children.
People expressed their anger during the funeral of Nichols that was also attended by the U.S. Vice President. Kamala Harris said the act of violence by police was not in line with public safety, adding that people have lost confidence in law enforcement agencies and do not feel safe. Nichols was arrested by the police in early January for a traffic violation. He was viciously beaten by five police officers at the scene and succumbed to his injuries 3 days later. The five policemen, who were also African-American, have since been fired by the Memphis Police Department and charged with second-degree murder. The Peruvian Congress has once again voted down a bid by President Dina Boluarte to move forward elections in order to calm down deadly unrest in the country.
Final voting results: 54 in favor, 68 against, 2 abstentions. Congress members, the Constitutional Reform Project has not reached the number of votes foreseen in Article 206 of the Constitution for its approval.
Congress rejected for the third time a bill that would advance elections to this year. Lawmakers had already agreed to reschedule the vote from 2026 to April 2024, but their move failed to satisfy protesters. President Boluarte had warned of a constitutional reform if Congress failed to act on her proposal. The reform would allow the country to hold a presidential election in October and a runoff in December. Peru plunged into political crisis in early December after former President Pedro Castillo was removed from office and detained for his attempt to dissolve Congress. Protesters, mainly supporters of Castillo, want Boluarte to quit and hold early elections. And the Philippines has granted the United States to boost its military presence in the country amid Washington's rising tensions with Beijing over the South China Sea and Taiwan. The deal would allow Washington to deploy military equipment and rotate its troops to 4 more bases. The U.S. has already allocated millions of dollars for the existing 5 sites under an agreement signed in 2014. New locations have not been specified, but former Filipino military chief said Washington had requested access to bases close to Taiwan. The move is part of U.S. plans to encircle China's maritime border in anticipation of a war over Taiwan, which Beijing considers as its own. Beijing's increasing assertiveness in the disputed South China Sea has also infuriated Manila. China lays claims over 90% of the sea and has deployed its naval forces there. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kHz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. in the limelight.
How the blockaded Gaza Strip looks like and how its residents deal with the hardships in the besieged area is hard to describe. Every day is a new tragic story which the Zionist regime has imposed on innocent Palestinians. However, the fabricated regime of Israel is getting close to its end. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, "This past August, Ahmad Amir, 34, stood atop the wreckage of a residential building in the northern Gaza Strip town of Beit Hanun. In the scorching sun, he smashed giant blocks of rubble with his hammer, breaking them into smaller pieces and loading them onto the back of a truck. Amir works for a construction company that recycles the debris and rubble left behind by Zionist regime attacks on Gaza, a business that shows no sign of letting up. The Zionist regime's three-day attack at the beginning of August 2022 killed at least 49 Palestinians and destroyed or damaged 2,000 homes throughout Gaza, including the building that Amir was scavenging on behalf of his employers. I'm conflicted between being glad that I got a job and upset that it came at a cost of other people losing their houses," Amir said. Amir had been unemployed for more than 5 years before getting this job in May 2021, shortly after another Israeli regime attack on the Gaza Strip destroyed over 2,200 homes. Before, Amir said, "I hardly ever got work and had to borrow money from my relatives to support my family at subsistence level. Now he works 12 hours a day for $15. The company he works for," he said, "employs its workers on a short-term contract basis and doesn't provide them with health insurance, even though the job itself is quite dangerous. There is the ever-present risk of a structural collapse since the buildings have not been completely leveled. At the least, falling debris can land workers in the hospital with a broken leg or arm. Amir believes the whole business is a cruel trick of fate. It does not seem just that one of the few sources of employment for residents of Gaza, with its 44% rate of unemployment, is among its ruins." According to Naji Sarhan of Gaza's Public Works and Housing Ministry, Gaza's rubble scavenging business dates back to the time of Operation Cast Lead. Taking place in late 2008 and early 2009, Cast Lead began a series of major Zionist regime attacks. During it, the fabricated regime of Israel destroyed or damaged over 11,000 housing units. Amid this destruction, the Gaza authorities devised a plan to reuse debris from destroyed buildings, said Sarhan. This reuse was essential since the Zionist regime has banned imports of so-called dual-use materials, which includes many building supplies as part of its 15-year blockade on Gaza. And despite the Gaza reconstruction mechanism, an arrangement overseen by Israeli regime that is supposedly intended to facilitate reconstruction has been proceeding slowly. All the debris that Amir collects will be transported to a crusher and then reconstituted into concrete blocks for reconstruction efforts or new building projects. Meanwhile, workers like Mohammad Medouch, 25, scavenge for another valuable building component, iron. Medouch lost his job at a garment factory in 2012 and has worked in the rubble salvage business since the summer of 2014, when the Zionist regime launched yet another major attack on Gaza. Despite sustaining multiple work injuries from falling debris, such as leg and arm fractures, he could not afford to take time off. He said, "I had no alternative but to accept this position. Anything is better than nothing in Gaza." Debris is also turning into a profitable business for some. Muhammad Abu Jabbar, 48, who runs numerous construction ventures, quickly adapted to the new economic environment and shifted his business focus on recycled rubble. He said, "Necessity is the mother of invention," stating that with so many Zionist regime's restrictions on construction supplies, there were severe shortages of cement and iron. As a result, in recent years, his cement block factory had decreased production by around 70% due to the Zionist regime's blockade. With the recycling of debris, his factory's production has seen an increase in production by 30% following the most recent assaults in 2021 and 2022. Abu Jabbar said that the Zionist regime tries to hinder the recycling process because they don't want our factories to operate and the city to be rebuilt. He said that the Zionist regime had even added the stone crushers to the list of banned import items, but that his company made local crushers out of used equipment and created roughly 20 tons of concrete per day. In addition to providing employment opportunities, recycled building materials are also cheaper. Abu Jabbar said at a locally produced cinder blocks cost $22 compared to $31 for an imported block. Even with cheaper materials on offer, many Gaza neighborhoods have still not been rebuilt. Only 40% of the completely demolished residential units from Operation Cast Lead have been rebuilt, according to Sarhan. What is the real cost of recycled materials? The cost of rebuilding Gaza is not cheap. A 2021 study by the World Bank, European Union, and the UN estimated that Gaza's immediate housing reconstruction needs totaled up to $160 million. While that study downplays the Zionist regime's direct role in the destruction, it also estimates that total reconstruction before the 2022 Israeli regime attacks would cost $345 to $485 million. Sarhan estimates that reconstruction buildings and infrastructure damaged by the Zionist regime attacks in 2021 and 2022 will cost at least $500 million. But who knows what it will cost after another Israeli regime attack? He said, "Israel frequently attacks Gaza City. Then, after one attack, they launch another attack on the city after it has been restored. But this time, in August 2022, Israel attacked the city before we had repaired half of the structures that had been devastated in the aggression of 2021. Each time the Zionist regime attacks Gaza, the reconstruction efforts begin anew. That's why contractor Samir Saad said the demand for recycled material keeps going on in Gaza. Saad said, "Since we began recycling, many residents have chosen to utilize recycled building materials to rebuild their structures since they are half as expensive as imposed ones," he added. "I understand it is only a short-term improvement because the city won't see real growth unless building materials are freely and regularly allowed to enter the city." Even then, he said, Gaza's true rebuilding needs were far from covered.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The death of 7 Israelis at a synagogue at the hands of a Palestinian, another shooting incident resulting in the injury of 2 Israelis. These incidents may have come as a shock to many, but it falls pale to the number of Palestinians that have been killed at the hands of the Israeli regime. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at Israel's security failure, the rise of grassroots Palestinians against the Israeli regime, and whether this new cabinet can even last what appears to be a wave of Palestinian resistance, including Israel's internal crisis with its own people. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Fra Hughes, author and director of Palestine Aid Belfast, joins us from Belfast. Also joining us is Arnold August, author and journalist, who joins us from Montreal.
Is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
All right, gentlemen, welcome to you. Fra Hughes, first to you. So you have 7 Israelis that were killed. 21 years old is the age of the person, or the Palestinian who did that. And then in less than 24 hours, you have another 2 that were injured in a shooting incident. This one was carried out by a 13-year-old. I'm mentioning the age because it's significant in the follow-up questions that I'm going to ask. What's your reaction to what has occurred, first of all?
Well, I think if we put things in context, as you've seen last year in 2022, 150 Palestinians were killed, murdered, some were already executed by the Israeli illegal occupation in the West Bank. And already in January and the first month of 2023, we have had up to 40 Palestinians, some were already executed, along with many, many more injured. I think if you look back at the history of the occupation, which is illegal, if you look at the 1 million illegal Zionist Israeli Jewish settlers in the West Bank. This is in contravention of the Fourth Geneva Convention, which states that Israel, as an occupying force, illegally occupying force, should not move its civilian population into the occupied territories. Indeed, in 2002 in Jenin, you had this refugee camp filled with refugees from 1948, when Israel, the Israeli state, was born in bloodshed by terrorism, by many of the people who went on to become the leaders of Israel at that time, were brought by the British government as terrorists. In 2002, you had 52 people murdered in Jenin by the illegal Zionist occupation forces. So there is a history going back to 1948 and the Nakba. There's a history going back to 1967 and the illegal occupation of the West Bank, of the continued ethnic cleansing of Palestinians from their land and from their homes. While Israeli settlers build homes illegally on land that has been confiscated or stolen or illegally occupied by the settler movement, they have stolen water resources, they have stolen arable land, and they have occupied the homes of the indigenous population. So when we see heavily armed troops going into Jenin, a refugee camp, in order to summarily arrest and or execute people, you know, you're going to have resistance to this oppression. And Palestinians, under international law, can use any and all means of resistance against this illegal occupation. And with the new right-wing Israeli government heavily kind of indebted to the settler movement, right, and getting a lot of their votes and a lot of their political value from the settler movement, I'm not surprised settlers have faced the brunt of Palestinian resistance.
Yeah, point well taken. I mean, if you want to take a look at this, Arnold August, what our guest there said, obviously there's a history there of the way that Palestinians have been violated in so many words. I mean, from the deaths to the detainment to all the core issues that exist. I mean, we can go through, we can't because we don't have the time, but so many ways that they have been violated. So many are not shocked at what has happened. And that is one of the most interesting points, because even Israelis, in terms of the outpouring, if you want to gauge even social media, even though they regret what has happened, but they're not really that shocked as they should be, because Israel has violated Palestinian rights so much, especially with the most recent massacre that occurred in Jenin refugee camp. So wasn't this a natural occurrence, as the Palestinian resistance groups have said, to occur, and this being based on what happened in Jenin with that massacre of the 10 Palestinians?
What you said and what Fred just mentioned as well, I think we're pointing to a very important scenario or analysis, and that is the resistance in Palestine is developing, has been developing for some time. And I guess this is one of the reasons that Israel tries to intimidate the Palestinian resistance, for example, what they did in Jenin. And I would like to say we're not alone in thinking that. I'm a member of the Board of Trustees of the Global Gathering in support of the Palestinian resistance, and they just issue a very powerful statement only a few hours ago, in which they say that this, they fully support the attack against the Israelis in Jerusalem, and is part of this wave of further development of Palestinian resistance using armed struggle. It is their only way. How else can Palestinians defend themselves if it is not for armed struggle? And I think that we are heading in that direction. And it's interesting that, as you mentioned, the reaction from the ground in Israel is not as powerful against this act by the Palestinians as it normally is. But I think it's one thing is clear, that Jerusalem is occupied by United States and Israel. And according to all laws and norms internationally, an occupied people have a right to resist. And this is what happened in Jerusalem yesterday. They had a right to resist. Of course, this is being, well, the United States, of course, their spokesman, Blinken, and others from the State Department, they didn't blink an eye. Sorry for the pun. They didn't blink an eye. They called it a terrorist organization, while at the same time saying, well, we don't have all the facts, what happened in Jerusalem yesterday. We know the facts. The main fact is that Israel, as an arm of the United States, has been carrying on this terrorist activity, as Fra just mentioned, for many years. We're talking about decades, and it is bound to erupt as it has in Jerusalem today, and who knows what will happen again. In fact, there was another attack only a few hours ago, so this is building up, and the armed resistance is building up. And the support of the Islamic Republic of Iran is very important for the morale and also armaments for the Palestinian resistance. This has to come to an end. We are in a stage where no one can turn a blind eye to the massacres, or I would say genocide, ongoing genocide by the Israeli Zionist entity against the Palestinian people.
Okay. Well, I just checked before I asked, I was going to ask you this question, Fra Hughes, as to whether there was an outcome from the cabinet meeting that Netanyahu has held. So far, there's no news on that. And the reason why I'm bringing this topic up is because, based on the source of an Israeli journalist and commentator who worked for Israel's Channel 13 News, he has said that the recommendations by Prime Minister Netanyahu will be for a law to deport families of terrorists, in reference to the Palestinians, immediate sealing of terrorist homes, arresting family members and friends, and then sending out reinforcements to the occupied West Bank. And then the last one, which we're going to get into later, approving more gun licenses to the civilian population of Israel. Now, that's really important, and I don't want to address have you address this now, because I'm going to ask the question later. But it doesn't. It does not sound appropriate to the degree of violence that you would expect from this cabinet. It almost sounds like they're somewhat intimidated. The tone of what's being proposed is not that extreme, if I may use that word, unless that's an incorrect interpretation of what's being proposed. Because one would think that would. You would think things like let's go to the Palestinian homes and get rid of Palestinians, etc. But it doesn't have that type of a tone to it. Am I reading this correctly, first of all?
I'm not sure. I think it's a very extreme reaction. I know over the years it has been Israeli policy, or has been in the past, to knock down the homes of the people who are involved in resistance and in resistance operations, and indeed to knock down maybe the homes either side or parallel to the home of the Palestinian resistance fighter. I mean, this is actually, a punitive revenge and retribution upon the community. This is collective punishment against individual acts. I heard the father of the martyr yesterday, who was involved in the operation in Al-Quds, say that he was unaware that his son was perhaps a member of any paramilitary resistance organization. He stated that, everyone has a different view on the occupation and how to resist that, or how to kind of rebel against what the occupation is doing. So, these community kind of repercussions where you knock down the home of the family. Indeed, it's the first time I've heard of Israel threatening to deport the families. I mean, are they going to deport them to Jordan? Are they going to deport them to Gaza, which is more likely? This is a form of continued ethnic cleansing, a continuation of the Nakba. I mean, if you have an intifada, for example, in the West Bank, and you have tens of thousands of young men, teenage boys, engaged in throwing bricks and bottles at armoured vehicles that can do absolutely no damage to them. When you look at the nine people who were martyred in Jenin, the Israeli army was claiming that there was a gun battle, but no Israeli troops have been injured. So, I mean, where are the guns? Where are the weapons? Where is the video camera surveillance? Because drones were involved and missiles were involved. And I read that their initial raid, that they came in a refrigerated van, in a civilian van, surrounded a house and fired missiles at it. So this is the response of the Israeli offensive forces, is to surround, attack. And apparently there were four people found dead in that building once the Israeli forces withdrew.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
What do you think, Arnold August, about these recommendations that supposedly is going to be brought up in this cabinet meeting? Again, this is not confirmed yet, but our guest there, and rightly so, says that these are pretty severe and extreme, because some of the comments that I'm reading now on social media are actually pointing towards that, saying they're ethnic cleansing, just like our guest Fraud Hughes there said. Because, for example, a law for deporting families of terrorists again, as Israel sees them, or immediate sealing of terrorist homes, or arresting family members and friends. These are all pretty severe, based on the viewpoint. Do you agree with that, that the steps taken are severe? Because it also points to the extinguishing the Palestinian existence off the land, in a sense.
Yes, it is a very serious set of situations, set of actions that the Israeli government is considering. But I think if they do that, it will backfire, because the Israelis know, whether they admit it or not, but the resistance, the armed resistance, for example, supported in to a large extent by Iran, and the resistance on the ground has been building up for several months now. And I like to, you know, the United States and Israel may be in for a surprise. I like to quote from the my board, in which I am a member, and they say openly that the person who carried that out in Jerusalem, Kari Al-Kam, is a young Magdisi resistance fighter who was breastfeeded with a Palestinian mother's milk. So here we go. While Israel is perhaps going to take some extreme action, the resistance, in my view, has never been stronger than it is now. And also the use of social media by the resistance. We often talk the social media used by United States or Israel, but the social media increasingly being used by the resistance is going to provide a further emphasis, a further impulse to the type of resistance that we're seeing, where the group gathering in Lebanon say openly, we have to use rifles, we have to use arms in order to overthrow the Zionist regime and head towards the liberation of Palestine. Uh-huh. So United States, they must be blustering, but there's the other side of the story as well. Increased development, the increased level of struggle based on any means necessary.
Well, this new phase, some have called it, Frahi, whether you agree or not, is my question to you, where you have these sole individuals, Palestinians, that is, who are emerging and acting on their own, even though they're carrying out pretty sophisticated operation, like what has happened in the past two incidents in the past 24 hours. Now, on the one hand, you have them so young. I mean, we're looking at 21-year-old and a 13-year-old that have carried it out. But it's somewhat smelling a new resistance, isn't it, in terms of the operation being carried out by them, because they have no affiliations with typical resistance groups like Islamic Jihad or Hamas. And one example, good example, I guess, would be a group by the name of Den of Lions that emerged in August of 2022, where they acted against the Israeli regime. Are we looking at this being a more common place incidents of these Palestinians with no affiliations rising up on their own? And, of course, it's because they're being choked by the Israeli regime in terms of a variety of things that you're well aware of.
Well, I think one of the major dangers that you've just alluded to for the Israeli state and for the settler movement is that I'm sure there are many brave members of the resistance groups, but I'm sure there are many people who are the eyes and ears of the Israeli security forces, Shin Bet, etc., Mossad, within the West Bank, who do watch the resistance groups, do watch the resistance fighters, do watch the commanders, and do inform on the resistance groups within the West Bank. So if you're going to have individuals and young people with absolutely no affiliations and be seen to be clean operatives, it'll be very difficult to stop these attacks going forward. And there's maybe two things I'd like to say. One of them is, I think it was Golda Meir who said that the old will die and the young will forget. Well, a 21-year-old Palestinian in Al-Quds did not forget, and a 13-year-old boy who apparently his brother has already been martyred by the Israeli illegal occupation. So if you're going to kill 16-year-old boys, you may well find their 13-year-old siblings coming forward demanding a pound of flesh. And it reminds me in many respects of the suicide bombings that happened in and around, I would guess, 2002, with what happened in Jenin. If you keep crushing a people, if you keep destroying their homes, stealing their futures, giving them nightmares instead of dreams of a peaceful future. People have nothing else to react with except their own lives. And if they're willing to submit their lives, to make a point and to fight the oppressive illegal regime that oppresses them and represses them, I think that that's something that you'll see more of.
Well, taking a look at Israel right now as we speak, in terms of its occupying Palestine, the land of Palestine, there are protests that are happening, Arnold, August, and I mentioned that in the beginning in my question. You have Israelis that are out there protesting. Now, take a guess as to what they are protesting. Your options would be A, are they protesting how they're against this cabinet, taking laws in their own hand, wanting to reform what they call judiciary, which is under question in terms of it even being a judiciary, or B, it's because of what happened, which is one of the worst attacks. In the past 24 hours, you have 7 Israelis that were killed, some in serious condition, with another 2 in a span of 24 hours. Which do you think they're protesting?
Well, I didn't see the footage of that, nor did I have a chance to read the report.
I'll tell you what they're protesting. They're protesting about those laws. To them, though there's 7 Israelis that were killed in less than 24 hours, that to them is not even a concern, because for them, their concern is how Netanyahu... Arnold August, are you with us? Okay, good. Their concern is how Netanyahu is trying to take laws into its own hands to try to decrease or trying to favor laws to its own favor, trying to reform laws to his own favor. Now, my question is, you have that on the one hand. You have Palestinians, young Palestinians with no affiliations rising up. You have the resistance groups at the same time. These are pulling this new cabinet apart in different directions. What are the chances of it surviving this?
I think, thank you for quoting that. It makes it very clear. So the people in Israel, occupied Palestine, who are demonstrating against the government, even though it may not be very clear, but if they're against the right-wing, very drastic attempts by the Netanyahu government against Palestine, it's very good that they are opposing it and in the streets to demonstrate against this genocidal policy. I'd like to make one comment. You mentioned some people who have been carrying it out these last actions in the last 2 days are not affiliated apparently with any other group. Well, I see this as a positive thing, because the organization of the armed resistance is no longer completely controlled, even though it is a good thing, by the formal resistance, that people are taking things in their own hands. Like 30 young people were killed in Palestine by Israel just in the month of January, and the month is not yet finished. So put yourself in a position of a young Palestinian. They have to fight back, and the only way is by armed resistance.
Thank you so much. Unfortunately, we're going to have to end it. We're fresh out of time. Arnold August there, author and journalist from Montreal. Thank you. And Fry Hughes, author and director of the Palestine Aid Belfast from Belfast. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. For Mika Batakwe and the team, it's goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ربنا
Supplication is the wealth of the believer and the bridge by which one achieves proximity to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the Exalted.
A path to salvation, a way to connect the two worlds. On the program, Bridge.
You're listening to the program Bridge on RIB English Radio with Sheikh Al-Musavi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, brothers and sisters, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatihi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program Bridge. We are looking at supplication number 8 of As-Sahif al-Sajjadiyah for Al-Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn Zainul Abidin, and we got to the part where the Imam says, and he prays to Allah and seeks refuge in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala from a number of things. And he says, wal israru ala al ma'atham, and to persist in sin. Now, human beings, we are not infallible. That's the first statement we make. And we are not immune to sins. That's the second statement we make. And we sin. That's a third statement we make. So, in general, generally speaking, being humans means that we make sins and we sin. At the same time, we are being told that if we sin due to our humanistic nature, we should seek forgiveness and repentance from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. But sometimes what we do as humans, we actually do the opposite, is that we have what we call israrun ala dhanb, persisting in sin. So I know it is sin, I know it's haram, but instead of me asking Allah to forgive me, I actually end up doing it all over again. Give you an example. For example, I know backbiting and ghibah is haram, but I keep doing it, and 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 it never ends. So even though it is a sin, I persist on it, and that's a big problem. Let us take a break, then we will continue.
A path to salvation, a way.